Welcome to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise, and sometimes my cat Winston joins me. This podcast contains content of a graphic nature that might not be suitable for all listeners, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to Season 4 of True Crime Cat Lawyer. Today's case is one we covered when we first started the show. I'd always planned on re-recording it, and now seemed like the perfect time since so much has happened since our initial recording. Unfortunately, though, this case, which is more than 30 years old, remains unsolved. But a man named Frank Gable spent almost that entire time locked away for the murder, despite strong evidence that he didn't commit the crime. Michael Franke's murder is on the short list of Oregon's most infamous murder cases. Franke was a native of Kansas City, Missouri, and attended the University of Virginia Law School before graduating in 1971. He was admitted to the Virginia Bar and served as a JAG, Judge Advocate General, in the U.S. Navy before being admitted to the New Mexico Bar in 1975. Franke was an Assistant Attorney General Counsel to the New Mexico Corrections Department until 1980. He then served as a judge for the First District Court in Santa Fe until 1983, when he became the director of the New Mexico Corrections Department. In May 1987, Franke was tapped by Oregon Governor Neil Goldschmidt to be the new director of Oregon's prison system. Goldschmidt was impressed with the reform work Franke had done in New Mexico, and he wanted Franke to do the same for Oregon. At the time of his murder, Franke had been in his position as director for almost 2 years. Starting in 1988, the state's prison population was growing. In January 1989, Franke was under some scrutiny for his expenditures and budget overruns. On the night of January 17, 1989, Franke attended his regular Tuesday meeting of directors at 5:30 p.m. This meeting was held in what is referred to as the Dome Building, which is the headquarters office of the Oregon Department of Corrections in Salem, Oregon. At 6:30 p.m., an unknown man wearing a pinstripe suit was seen inside the Dome Building. This man has never been positively identified. 15 minutes later, at 6:45, Franke was seen alive for the last time. He told his coworker Dave Colley that he was going to his office to call his wife. Cell phones weren't a thing at this time, so it makes sense that Franke would have to go back to his office to call someone. At 7 p.m., the building custodian, Wayne Hunsaker, left the Dome Building and saw two men. He would later tell investigators that one of the men walked slowly toward the entrance of the Dome Building, while the other man ran off to the west of the building. Just 5 to 8 minutes later, two state hospital employees noticed Franke's car in the parking lot with the door open, but no signs of Franke or anyone else around the car. Between 7:15 and 7:30, two corrections employees left the Dome Building and also noticed Franke's car with the door open in the parking lot. At that point, they tried to page Franke. All four employees told maintenance worker Larry Hill about what they saw and that Franke didn't answer their pages and never returned to his car. The employees then headed home. Hill decided to look for Franke, but he didn't find him. This was around 8:10 p.m. By this point, Hill notified Franke's coworker, Dave Colley, that no one had been able to find Franke. Colley called the second-in-command, Dick Peterson, and the two searched the Dome Building. But they didn't search the north porch at that time. This was around 8:45 p.m. They found no sign of Franke, and his car remained in the parking lot with the door open. At no point during any of these searches were police called. At 10:20, a witness reported seeing 5 to 6 men running away from the front of the Dome Building. Again, police weren't called. Hill, the building maintenance worker, returned to the Dome Building at 11:45 p.m. He didn't see any sign of Franke, but he did see Franke's car still in the parking lot. On January 18, 1989, at 12:40 a.m., hospital security officer Stephen Rubens came across the body of Michael Franke on the north porch near the north entrance of the Dome Building. Franke's body was covered in bruises, abrasions, and other wounds. His cause of death was a stab wound to the heart. Despite there being no trace of blood within 100 feet of the car, police believed that Frankie was stabbed at his car and dumped on the north porch. Frankie's watch and wallet were still on his body, but his briefcase was missing. The murder weapon wasn't found on either the north porch or near Frankie's car. According to the Unsolved Mysteries episode on this case, Frankie had a state-of-the-art car alarm system. But if you remember, none of the witnesses mentioned anything about hearing a car alarm going off. A car alarm is a pretty annoying sound that you would probably remember. Because of this, police hypothesized that Frankie most likely walked to his car, unlocked it, and deactivated the alarm before being abducted by 5 or 6 men. Those men then brought Frankie back to the Dome building, where he was later found. In May 1989, nearly 6 months after Frankie's murder, police interviewed Frank Gable for the first time. Police had received a tip that Gable had information about the case from a man named Michael Kearns. Kieran claimed that Gable made a jailhouse confession to him while the two were incarcerated together. Despite the initial theory that 5 or 6 men were involved in the abduction and murder of Frankie, once police had Gable in their sights, their theory completely changed to fit their suspect, rather than the evidence. A man named Earl Childers claimed that he saw Gable near the scene of the crime. A quote-unquote local teenage runaway named Jody Swearingen would testify before a grand jury that she witnessed Frankie's murder and she would identify Gable as the perpetrator. 4 other quote-unquote witnesses would also place Gable at or near the crime scene on the night of Frankie's murder. The grand jury, which was convened in July of 1989, indicted Gable on April 6, 1990. He was charged with 6 counts of aggravated murder and 1 count of murder. Even though police and prosecutors thought they had their man, others weren't so sure. There was no physical or DNA evidence linking Gable to the crime. Also, if Gable's motive for the murder was a robbery gone wrong, why leave Frankie's wallet and watch? At the time of his arrest, Gable was known as a small-time meth dealer in the Salem area. So, not exactly an upstanding citizen, but also not necessarily a murderer. In February 1991, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode on this case, even though Gable had been arrested and was awaiting trial for Frankie's murder at that time. At Gable's trial, Jody Swearingen testified once again that she saw Gable murder Frankie. The prosecution didn't have the murder weapon, but the judge allowed them to introduce a knife that they had purchased that matched Frankie's wounds into evidence. The prosecution even had Gable's ex-wife testify that she gave him a knife similar to the one the prosecution had purchased. So with 5 or 6 witnesses providing testimony against Gable and the knife quote-unquote evidence offered by the prosecution, the jury found Gable guilty of aggravated murder on June 27, 1990. On July 11, 1991, Gable was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. As far as police and prosecutors were concerned, the case was closed. They convicted the man responsible for Frankie's murder, and everyone could move on. In August 1991, Gable was transferred to an Idaho prison. The investigation and trial of Frank Gable cost the state of Oregon $2 million, and yet, people still weren't sure that they could really close the case. In April 1994, the Oregon Court of Appeals upheld Gable's conviction. Meanwhile, several witnesses had recanted their testimony. It came out that a lot of witness testimony was obtained through coercive interrogation tactics. 20 years after the Court of Appeals upheld Gable's conviction, the Federal Public Defender's Office filed to reopen Gable's case. It took 5 long years, but Gable was finally released from prison in June 2019. During his appeal, Gable had the support of Frankie's brothers, Kevin and Patrick. They were both convinced of Gable's innocence and even started a GoFundMe page to help raise funds for Gable's defense. Even though Gable was released in June 2019, his legal battles didn't end there. The state appealed his release to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In September 2022, the Ninth Circuit affirmed the decision to vacate Gable's murder conviction. The court said that the case against Gable was built entirely on a tainted foundation of false testimony and questionable investigation tactics. Quote, "The facts on appeal are extraordinary. Since trial, nearly all the witnesses who directly implicated Gable have recanted. Many explained that they intended to frame Gable after hearing he was a police informant. They attribute their false testimony to significant investigative misconduct, which the state remarkably doesn't dispute," end quote. The court also addressed the fact that another man confessed to the murder multiple times, but his confessions were excluded from Gable's trial. That's right, someone else confessed to the murder more than once, and they still put Frank Gable on trial. A few weeks after Frankie's murder, a man named John Krause, who was on parole for robbery at the time, made an unprompted statement to his parole officer. He said that he had information about Frankie's murder, and he told his parole officer that he saw a group of men beating up another man, presumably Frankie, outside the Dome building. But Krause had a second story to tell. In the second version, Krause said that a man named Juan paid him $300,000 to kill Frankie. In April 1989, Krause said that he was walking by the Dome building when he decided to break into a car. He said that Frankie caught him in the act and tried to detain him. Krause said that he punched Frankie in the face and stabbed him so he could get away. Krause repeated his confession three more times to various family members in the presence of law enforcement. First, he called his brother and confessed, and this call was recorded. Then, Krause called his mom and confessed yet again. Finally, police brought in Krause's girlfriend, and while he was in tears, Krause confessed to Frankie's murder for the third time. Krause did recant twice, and after his first recantation, Krause then recanted his recantation a few days later. In June 1989, Krause had yet another version to tell. He claimed that he was involved in a conspiracy with corrections officials who wanted Frankie killed because Frankie had found out that these officials were allowing drugs to be smuggled into the prison. Several months later, prosecutors offered Krause immunity for any false statements he made to police. Krause initially accepted the immunity deal, but he later recanted for the final time. Gable's defense team argued at his trial that Krause provided details that were consistent with evidence that hadn't been publicly released, and they should be allowed to present this at Gable's trial. But the prosecution objected, and the judge ultimately refused to allow the defense to present this evidence at Gable's trial. So the Ninth Circuit addressed Krause and his confessions in their opinion. They found Krause's confessions compelling. Krause, quote, confessed within months of the murder, multiple times in several forms, to nearly impeachable witnesses and his family with no apparent ulterior motive and clearly against his penal interest, end quote. These detailed and accurate confessions were made under circumstances that strongly supported their reliability. For one, Krause gave details of the crime that weren't known to the public, including how many times Frankie had been stabbed and where he was stabbed. After reviewing the case, the Ninth Circuit agreed with the lower court's decision to vacate the murder conviction on the basis that Gable's due process rights were violated by the exclusion of Krause's confession. They felt that, quote, no reasonable juror could ignore the heavy blow to the state's evidence given the significance of the recantations, end quote. And that's because the state had relied solely on eyewitness testimony, which was now worthless with all the witnesses who incriminated Gable recanting their statements. The state tried to argue that even if every recantation was credited, there was still enough evidence to convict Gable. But the Ninth Circuit disagreed, saying that the only three witnesses who didn't recant had been thoroughly impeached. 2 months after the Ninth Circuit handed down its decision, the state appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that the Ninth Circuit had wrongly second-guessed the state trial judge who barred Krause's confession. The state argued that Krause's confessions were untrustworthy because he didn't make them under oath and no one else had corroborated his account. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the state's appeal in April 2023. The following month, a federal judge ordered Gable's unconditional release and barred the state from retrying him. The murder indictment against Gable was dismissed with prejudice. That means that the state of Oregon can never rearrest, reindict, or retry Gable for the murder of Michael Frankie. Before the May 2023 decision, Gable was in limbo. He had been on federal supervision since his release in June 2019. Gable was ecstatic at the decision, and Frankie's brothers were completely supportive and also excited and happy that the judge finally ended the legal saga for Gable. On November 15th, 2023, just a few weeks ago, Gable's attorneys filed a $2 million lawsuit against Marion County and the state of Oregon. Gable spent nearly 11,000 days in prison for a crime he didn't commit. According to the wrongful conviction compensation law in Oregon, a person who was convicted of a felony and subsequently had the conviction reversed, vacated, or received a pardon from the governor is eligible for compensation from the state. The rate applicable for Gable is $65,000 for each year of wrongful incarceration plus $25,000 for each year the person was wrongfully on probation or parole. This is how Gable's attorneys calculated their $2 million figure. Gable can also file a federal civil rights lawsuit in the future. The Oregon Department of Justice has 30 days to dispute Gable's wrongful conviction petition. So if Gable didn't kill Frankie, who did? A few theories have been offered over the years, mostly surrounding a potential conspiracy or cover-up by those in positions of power in the Oregon government. There is evidence that leads credence to this conspiracy theory. Just before he was murdered, Frankie told his family that he had found evidence of corruption within the prison system that would implicate several top government officials, but no paperwork related to this investigation has ever been found. Although it should be noted, investigators did see 23 bags of shredded paper in Frankie's office after they started conducting their investigation. I should also note that a federal investigation was conducted in 1986, which resulted in the resignation of the prison superintendent and several corrections officers being fired, which is the reason why Frankie had been brought in to quote-unquote clean house. The FBI actually looked into a possible connection between corruption and drug smuggling at the Oregon State Penitentiary and Frankie's murder in July 1989. At the time of Frankie's murder in January of 1989, corrections officers and other staff weren't searched as they entered the prison. Because of this, some COs became involved with smuggling drugs and other contraband into the prison. But nothing appears to have come from this federal investigation. Along with the assassination/conspiracy theories, a few names have popped up over the years as potential suspects or perpetrators besides John Krause. First, there was Tim Natividad, a local Salem drug dealer. He was first offered as a potential suspect by none other than Jody Swearingen, the teen runaway who testified against Gable before the grand jury and at Gable's trial. Basically, she gave the same story as before, only she subbed Gable for Natividad. There were also rumors that Hoyt Cupp, the former warden of the Oregon State Penitentiary, gave Natividad $20,000 to kill Frankie. We'll never know if any of this is true, though. Natividad was killed 2 weeks after Frankie's murder, and Cupp died of cancer in 1990. Another potential witness was Scott McAllister. He was the assistant attorney general for the state of Oregon, but he resigned shortly before Frankie was murdered. He was allegedly selling parole to inmates, which some people thought that Frankie might have found out about before his death. But to my knowledge, there's no evidence to substantiate either claim. McAllister later became the Inspector General of the Utah Department of Corrections. The last potential suspect doesn't have a name. He's only known as Pinstripe Suit Man. A few different witnesses saw this man on the night of the murder. According to one source, this man may have posed as a copy machine repairman in order to gain access into the dome building. One article I read said that the copy machine was taken apart but never put back together, and there was no sign that any repairs had been made. No one else from the copy machine company came out to complete the repairs, and there was no record of any service repair call in the copy machine company's records. And that's the story of the unsolved murder of Michael Frankie. It's been over 30 years, and there are still no answers for Frankie's brothers, Kevin and Patrick. From what I can tell, police still seem to think that Gable was the perpetrator, and they haven't done any further investigating since Gable was released in 2019. This case has long gone cold, and there's no telling whether it'll ever be solved. If you have any information about the murder of Michael Frankie, you can submit a tip on the Unsolved Mysteries page for this case. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Please subscribe and leave a review if you like the show. You can email case suggestions or comments to truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. The links for our social media pages are included in the show notes. And if you want more content, head over to Patreon to join one of our available tiers. Finally, if you're interested in learning more about my co-host, you can check out her Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening and stay tuned for our next episode.